It's Friday, June 18th. Its heart rate spiked for a second, but Obamacare's alive and not going anywhere. We start here. The Affordable Care Act survives its third and perhaps final Supreme Court test.
You can't just bring a lawsuit because you don't like a law. The law has to affect you.
And that wasn't the only big-time case of the week. We'll analyze the message from an unusually united court. Washington declares a new national holiday, but can it push through anything else?
We have 21 senators now signed onto this bipartisan deal.
From voting rights to infrastructure, we might have just seen honest-to-goodness movement here. And Juneteenth was just the end of one era. He says it wasn't the end of the land grab.
The very agency that's supposed to be lending me a hand up was the very agency putting black farmers out of business.
Forget symbolism. Black farmers are daring America to reap what it's sown. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. Generally speaking, the Supreme Court gets to do what it wants. The nine justices get to decide which cases they hear, which cases they don't. But there are lots of traditions, lots of norms, and normally the Supreme Court always seems to save its biggest decisions for the end of its terms. Those split decisions, 5-4 votes that can dramatically shape the nation, usually those come on the last day of the June schedule.
Hi, everyone. I'm Diane Macedo. We're coming on the air with breaking news. The Supreme Court has just rejected a challenge to the Affordable Care Act for the third time.
So yesterday, when we heard the Supreme Court had issued two of its most anticipated decisions of the year, including one challenging the existence of this country's biggest health legislation this century, we thought, weird that these close calls came kind of early on in June.
This was a 7-2 decision, and it brings relief tonight for the 31 million who depend on it for their insurance.
But then you looked at the rulings themselves, and you realize that to the court, these were not close calls. These weren't narrowly divided decisions. And as much as the opinions themselves, these vote counts send a strong message that Obamacare is truly here to stay. Let's go straight to ABC senior national correspondent Terry Moran, who covers the court. Terry, it's been almost a decade since the Supreme Court upheld the Affordable Care Act for the first time. But I mean, how close were we to Obamacare just kind of going away yesterday?
Well, the lower courts had decided it should go away altogether on this case brought by the state of Texas and other Republican-led states and two individuals who were complaining that the individual mandate that requires most Americans to purchase health insurance was tyrannical, basically, was unconstitutional. And so lower courts had basically decided Obamacare should go. And here they were with a 7-2 opinion, four conservatives joining the liberal justices to say no. Obamacare is here to stay.
A judge striking down Obamacare.
The federal judge in Texas ruling the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional because...
And the reason was a fine point of law, standing. In our country, under our Constitution, you can't just bring a lawsuit because you don't like a law. The law has to affect you. It has to impact you in a way that is concrete and cognizable by the court, to use their language.
Without a hard repeal, Republicans chipped away at President Obama's signature health care bill, effectively ending the financial penalties associated with the individual mandate, which, according to the Texas District Court, now makes Obamacare unconstitutional.
And what the court said in this case, there's no real injury here. That individual mandate, there's no penalty. The government's not going to come after you if you don't pay it, if you don't get health insurance. And so there's no case here. This was an attempt to enlist the courts in the Republicans' political effort to bring down this law. And seven justices said, nope, we aren't going there.
Well, so you and I have talked about how the court is getting more conservative over the years with the justices that President Trump brought in. But you look at these rulings. I'm like the original one in 2012 upholding the ACA. That was 5-4. The next one, there's another one, was 6-3. This was 7-2. Is the argument over Obamacare done?
You'd think so. That's clearly the message they're sending. And I think there's something else going on. The court looks at the tumult in the country. Chief Justice John Roberts in particular, but others. Justice Elena Kagan, Justice Stephen Breyer, who wrote this opinion. Justice Brett Kavanaugh and even Amy Coney Barrett, they're institutionalists to some degree or another. They don't want to be in the muck and mire of our politics. And so one of the things you're seeing in these cases is a court where many of the justices seem to be looking for ways to come together, stick to the fine points of the law, and stay out of politics.
Hey, Terry, Walk me through the other big ruling of the day, because this was billed as a religious freedom case, as a gay rights case. But then again, you look at the tally and it's even more lopsided than the Obamacare ruling.
This was a unanimous case, Brad.
Justice is siding with the Catholic Social Services Agency in its contract dispute with the city of Philadelphia over same-sex foster parents.
There had been no complaints against Catholic Social Services.
The agency refused to certify LGBT people as foster parents as a matter of faith. Lower federal courts sided with the city, but today all nine justices of the U.S. Supreme Court voted to reverse course.
Once again, a fine point of law. That because that Philadelphia anti-discrimination law allowed for exceptions to be made for some people and then not to others, under our law and constitution, again, the government has to have a very strong reason for doing
so. So bad for LGBTQ parents and good for the Catholics in Philadelphia? Like, what does that mean?
In the short term, yes. But the underlying message here is that if Philadelphia had written its law without an exception, meaning everybody is automatically covered by this law, no exceptions, then that gets to the real battle the conservatives want to fight, which is an effort to carve out a new exception for religious freedom in a lot of these cases.
The decision was not a sweeping victory, but this is a good outcome.
Gay rights advocates looked at this as a kind of victory, as a step on the road.
In that the court, again, is finally saying that discrimination has no place in our foster care or adoption systems.
Because the court did not say that Philadelphia cannot decline to do business with the Catholic Social Services. What they said was, if you're going to have that law, apply it to all.
If you do apply these laws, you have to make sure you apply them in a neutral and generally applicable way.
So the gay rights advocates say, okay, we'll rewrite the law. Everybody has to be covered by that anti-discrimination law. And we'll see how that fares in the court.
Right, Terry Moran, covering the Supreme Court, also the host of The Breakdown on ABC News Live, breaking it down for us here. Thank you so much, Terry.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, Juneteenth is tomorrow. Well, it's kind of today. How the nation is wrapping its collective mind around its newest holiday after the break.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much I know.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.
As of yesterday morning, this country had 10 federal holidays. As of today, it's got 11. And the newest one is June 19th.
Throughout history, Juneteenth has been known by many names. Jubilee Day, Freedom Day, Liberation Day, Emancipation Day. And today, a national holiday.
Yesterday, in his first official act back on American soil, President Biden signed into law a bill that makes Juneteenth a federal holiday recognizing the end of slavery. And in the lead up to this moment, with President Biden out of the country all week, there's actually been a lot of movement on Capitol Hill, especially in the area of voting rights. ABC's Trish Turner is in the Senate right now. First question, Trish, does everyone get the day off today? Like, Juneteenth is a Saturday, right? So are you taking the day off today? Are you going to work?
I never get a day off, but I am going to tell you, this place is a ghost town. No one's here. The Capitol Police, well, there are a few Capitol Police here. They have to be here, but they've limited the entrances into the Capitol. All the offices are closed. And yeah, it's pretty extraordinary.
This vote, the yeas are 415 and the nays are 14.
And they did it, you know, Congress passed this in just days. It was really head spinning bipartisanship that we never see. So yeah, the day off. What do you know?
All right. So another federal holiday. Let's talk about then about voting rights, since a lot of people would say that's actually kind of in the spirit of what Juneteenth is recognizing here. There's been this question of what Democrats can accomplish with just 50 votes. But they haven't even really had 50 votes when you talk about this big voting rights package that President Biden wants to push through.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So Democrats in the Senate have had 49 votes. They are one shy. They have 50 Democrats in their caucus. So all of the white hot spotlight has been on one man, Joe Manchin. He's practically a household name.
This is one of the most, I think, important things that we can do in trying to bring our country back together. And to do it in a partisan way is not going to be successful, I believe.
So they have been working him over. Civil rights groups have been calling. He has been on, I don't know how many conference calls we've heard about.
Joe Manchin is doing everything in his power to stop democracy and to stop our work for the people.
And his own colleagues have buttonholed him. So finally this week, he made public his list of demands for how he wants to see this gargantuan piece of legislation, this S1, change so that they could get his support. And we were really surprised that, you know, the very next day, Stacey Abrams, really high profile endorsement, she comes out in favor of this.
Those provisions that he is setting forth are strong ones that will create a level playing field, will create standards that do not vary from state to state, and I think will ensure that every American has improved access to the right to vote.
This is pretty crucial endorsement, and it's really critical, Brad, that Democratic leadership really wants the entire caucus united on this, particularly as a very high profile statement against what's happening across the country in red states.
Right, and you got to imagine there's also Democrats thinking, hey, if Joe Manchin hangs his hat on voting rights, like if he's in our camp now, what happens if Republicans swat this down? Could he get closer to maybe blowing up the whole concept of a filibuster? Because that would change everything. Does not seem like Joe Manchin is there at all yet. In the meantime, Trish, every week I feel like I ask you, well, also, what about infrastructure? And every week you say, it's weird, Brad, because there are all these groups kind of working on it. No one thinks that any of these proposals is anywhere close to 60 votes. Well, now, like, people on the Hill are saying the math literally just changed in the last few days.
It's interesting because we have been inching along with this and, you know, following these negotiations in the bowels of the Capitol where this group of 10, senators, five Democrats, five Republicans have been crafting a compromise. But surprisingly this week, we got five more Democrats, five more Republicans, actually six more Republicans. So we have 21 senators now signed onto this bipartisan deal that's moving. And you know, it really does give it a lot of momentum.
It focuses just on physical infrastructure, so roads, rails, and bridges. And while the president's latest counteroffer was for roughly $1 trillion in new spending, this plan calls for only $579 billion.
We have Republican leaders, you know, talking favorably about it. The White House is engaged, and all signs point to momentum for this particular bipartisan proposal. But let's go back to that 60 votes. And, you know, Chuck Schumer has a bit of a math problem here. He could lose Democratic support.
I'm a former mayor. And what I know is that unless you invest in infrastructure, it's only going to get worse. And it's only going to be more expensive.
Oh, like you get 11 centrist Republicans and you're like, wow, we have 61 votes. Except wait, you're forgetting Bernie Sanders, people. Like, he's not necessarily going to vote yes.
Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, these people fall off on the other end. But, you know, with the 21 senators signing on to this bipartisan traditional infrastructure plan this week, you began to see maybe, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel. There is maybe a pathway forward for this legislation, but we'll see.
Well, and that's what this infrastructure sounds like it would entail, would be lights and tunnels and also some roads and bridges, perhaps. Trish Turner, working at the Senate on a holiday, I guess. Happy Juneteenth observed, Trish. Thanks a lot for the time.
Oh, to you too. Thank you.
And when we talk about Juneteenth as a holiday, this bill passed overwhelmingly in Congress, but there were pockets of dissent. Some conservatives, mainly white conservatives, said this day, technically called National Independence Day now, would fundamentally become a day about dividing Americans. Which day do you consider Independence Day, July 4th or June 19th? But some black Americans were not particularly jazzed about this either. Not because it's not a worthy day for a holiday, but because, activists said, lack of holidays is not the problem in this country. That doesn't fix anything. And all the effort it took to push this holiday through could have been spent, well, helping people. Well, later tonight, ABC will present a special examining areas in which things are changing and talking to people affecting that change. It's a great team working on it. Michael Strahan is talking to former President Obama as part of this. And one segment in particular really caught my eye when ABC's Kenneth Moten went out to the farm fields of the South to explore the challenges faced by America's black farmers. Kenneth joins us now. And Kenneth, one of the questions you ask is basically just why aren't there more black-owned farms? And the folks you spoke to said there are real answers to that.
There really is. And the reason that we've seen a lack of black farmers in this country is systemic discrimination, according to those who have a history of farming this land, of tilling the land, growing crops out of this land, tending to livestock. These black farmers who say, look, they've been there for generations. They've been there since slavery.
Our ancestral grandmothers had the courageous audacity to braid seeds into their hair before being forced onto transatlantic slave ships. The okra, cowpea, millet, black rice. And
they say this all started 400 years ago when they came to this land, and they were used for more than just labor. They were used for their knowledge of how to grow food out of the land.
Folks in Northern Europe did not know how to farm in Brazil and Cuba and Florida and Virginia. It's an entirely different climate.
And so you've got these farmers who say, yes, when slavery ended, really, it kind of continued with sharecropping, which allowed these black farmers to rent land often from the former slave owners.
Like sharecropping is almost a generous term when you think about what it actually means. Like, it's not like we're sharing this pasture.
Right, exactly. And when it comes to sharecropping, it's something that I know all about intimately because of my family history. I'm a South Carolina boy, and so my great-great-great-grandfather, Henry Moten, was a sharecropper. Hmm. And I was blessed enough to know my great-grandfather, who told me stories about growing food, because when it comes to property, it's so important for the black family to actually own something. You know, there was that promise of, you know, acres and a mule.
If 40 acres and a mule had been a promise kept, that would be worth almost $7 trillion today.
And for many, it was a broken promise. Hearing the dogs reminds me. So what all do you have on this land?
I have, I raise row crops here, such as soybeans, corn, wheat.
And so I met this farmer down in Southern Virginia. He is the founder of the National Black Farmers Association.
For my livestock, so we do.
John Boyd Jr. This is a man straight out of Central Casting when it comes to farmers, Brad, wearing all black, you know, got this cowboy hat on, got the boots on. For you, yeah. Farming, that's in your blood.
It's in my blood. I'm a fourth generation farmer.
And so I'm on his land, and he's giving me the history of the land. He's telling me about his family.
My grandfather, Thomas Boyd, was born in 1894. So when I tell my kids this, they can't believe that I knew somebody from the 1800s.
You just see the pride when he talks about being a property owner.
Well, and that's what's interesting to me, Kenneth, is like you said, there's the history of black people in this country not having the land that first was forcefully taken from them and then was kept from them and then was rented to them. But it's not just a history lesson that you're going over. Like, there are current things happening now that affect whether a black American can afford to own a farm.
Being in that loan office.
Yes.
With that USDA official. In modern history, there are things going on. And for John Boyd Jr., he is a man who has fought the system.
It's Wednesday, the only day he saw black farmers.
They had a day for you?
Yeah.
For Wednesday. Black farmers?
Wednesday.
One day.
One
out of
day
the week.
A week. We named it Black Wednesday.
In fact, in the 80s, he has a number of stories about discrimination from the USDA.
In the 80s, they still had the word Negro on the USDA application.
In the 80s?
Yes. So one of my first fights was to get the word Negro, you know.
He actually calls the U.S. Department of Agriculture the last plantation.
Hmm.
And that just gave me chills when he said that to me.
The numbers support exactly what I'm sitting here telling you. And you can look at, since 1995, $500 billion with a T have been paid out to large-scale white farmers in this country in the form of just subsidies. And a little to none has went to black farmers in this country.
And it was so rampant, the discrimination, it was so bad that he and a number of other farmers sued. And in 1999, the USDA settled for $100 million. And the USDA, I should say, we reached out to them. They say that they are committed to a more inclusive USDA. But for the farmers who are just trying to hold onto their land, the black farmers who are trying to hold onto their land, they're having a really tough time, Brad.
And you don't have those resources, you can't compete. No matter how good of a farmer I am, I still need money to buy my seed and lime and fertilizer and diesel fuel.
A century ago, we saw nearly a million black farmers. Today, that number is roughly 50,000.
Wow.
More than 90% of land by black farmers has been lost
wow.
over the past century.
The very agency that's supposed to be lending me a hand up was the very agency putting black farmers out of business.
Well, so where does this go from here, Kenneth? Because, you know, like beyond the settlements, are there instances now in 2021 where black farmers are still saying, hey, this system is still locking us out?
Yeah, black farmers believe that when it comes to their white counterparts, they're just not being treated equally when it comes to the loan process, when it comes to debt relief. And so you've got President Biden, who just signed that $2 trillion American Rescue Plan with $5 billion going to farmers of color. But then we just recently had a big development in the past few days or so where a court ruled, after some majority white farmers sued to stop it, to have an injunction, the judge agreed with them and said that the doling out of this debt relief money, it shouldn't be based on race.
You're still waiting on COVID relief.
Yeah, I thought we'd better got it by now so I could, you know, get a crop in the ground this year.
And so you've got some farmers that I spoke with, who one in particular in Southern Virginia, whose farm is in foreclosure.
So I ain't been able to put up no buildings on this place or buy no new tractors.
And he has been waiting on pins and needles to get that debt relief. And it looks like it won't happen for him in time.
Do you think about those who came before you?
I absolutely do. I know that they were slaves and sharecroppers that built these barns.
You know, Brad, as I said, this goes back hundreds of years. It goes back to slavery.
We cleaned up the South. We cleaned up the country. We made the tobacco, gold, and cotton king.
And for black farmers, they believe that they helped build this country and they helped feed it. And just as important, to own your own property. There are so many who just want to keep that going.
The most powerful tool you can possess, only secondary to Jesus Christ, is land ownership.
It's a really important look, I think, at something that's not always necessarily at top of mind when we talk about race relations and economics in this country. Kenneth Moten, we'll see you on the Juneteenth special tonight on ABC. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
All right, we're going to take one more quick break. When we come back, you thought they were unpopular during COVID? Well, imagine how the World Health Organization will be seen when they tell everyone not to drink. One Last Thing is next. And one last thing, there's always been the medical debate. How much drinking exactly is unhealthy for a pregnant woman? Well, if you thought that was fraught, the World Health Organization just blew right past that debate and started another. The group, which has come under fire before from both sides of the American political spectrum, has now issued a first draft of a report about alcohol use, and in it, gives some recommendations for who should be prevented from drinking.
The World Health Organization accused of scaremongering after suggesting in its draft global alcohol plan that women of childbearing age should avoid drinking alcohol entirely, arguing it could harm their chances of giving birth.
This is just flabbergasting. It's jaw-dropping, in my opinion.
That's ABC's chief medical correspondent, Dr. Jennifer Ashton, who, by the way, is a board-certified OBGYN. And she's sharing the opinion of lots of medical professionals around the world this morning, which is namely, what? What is the World Health Organization talking about?
It's been known for a long time that alcohol consumption during pregnancy can be harmful to the developing fetus. But in the field of obstetrics, in the area of women's health, we try to take a more holistic view and not just look at women of childbearing age like they're potential vessels or incubators for a developing human.
Around the globe, there was this kind of confusion because women are potentially able to conceive until, what, age 50? So is the WHO telling women under 50, all of them, to just not drink at all in case they become pregnant someday?
Fertility is a gift directly from God.
In the U.S., comparisons were instantly being made to The Handmaid's Tale, in which policies are crafted exclusively around getting young women to conceive.
You girls will serve the leaders of the faithful. and their barren wives. You will bear children for them.
And in 2021, to take a view that all women of childbearing age can't be trusted to modify or modulate their own behavior as circumstances dictate is not only unrealistic, it's paternalistic. It's frankly idiotic.
Now, we should be clear. This was just a draft document. The World Health Organization has not commented on the ensuing backlash, but it was put out for the international medical community to comment on. They got their wish and the hangover that goes with it. I asked an ABC News producer, a colleague who just had a baby who's still childbearing age, if she will swear off glasses of wine from now on, just in case she ever has another kid. Her answer was, and I quote, Start Here is produced by David Rind, Kelly Therese, Josh Cohan, Ariel Chester, Tara Gimbel, Lauren Efron, and happy almost birthday Lewis Millman, whose birthday now falls on a federal holiday. Thanks to Liz Alessi, Eric Johnson, Lakia Brown, John Newman, Elizabeth Russo, and Stacia Deshishku. Special thanks this week to Ben Gittleson, Chris Berry, Kirsten Crawford, Connor Finnegan, Bobby Galen, Jim Ryan, David Toledo, Madeline Wood, and Sarah Kolonofsky. I'm Brad Milkey. See you Monday.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.